Douglas Adams, the wonderful writer of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, said something wonderful about inventions that I think about a lot. He said, anything that was invented before you were born has always been there and is normal. Anything invented in the time you're 30 is new, and it's yours, and most likely you'll make a living doing it. And finally, anything invented after 30 is wrong and needs to be stopped. Let's think about that first part for a second. For me, it's easy to imagine Australian music always had a place and was always rewarded. And that we have been tracking pop music since the beginning of time. And that institutions remain. But by the time I started collecting physical copies of the Coca-Cola ARIA charts and watching the ARIA Awards, both those institutions were actually quite new. It took a while for the Australian music industry to really start tracking and looking at itself. But right away, ARIA was the mansion on the hill. It was the music that had made it to the top. But that mansion on the hill couldn't escape what was happening on the streets in the 90s. How did it all look from that mansion, and which bands managed to break in? Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week, we look at how the alternative music world did and didn't invade the ARIA charts and awards. ARIA started in the 1970s as a trade association for major Australian labels. There's similar ones in the US and the UK. The US one is called the RIAA. It's the same four letters as ARIA, but they didn't think to change their letters around to be a musical term. The RIAA doesn't have the charts or awards. They leave that to separate businesses like Billboard and the Grammys. In the UK, it's separate companies called the UK Chart Company and the Brit Awards. In fact, having the key recorded music trade body administer the official chart and the awards is unique to Australia. If this was a podcast about the British 90s alternative music scene, whatever the cobblers that means, there's no real way for me to combine the charts and the awards in one episode. The ARIA charts only officially started in 1983. Before that, there was a strange series of competing charts, but it was hard to get all that data together, pre-digital, across a big country. And the 1983 first ARIA charts were just ARIA taking over another chart, branding-wise. ARIA only took the charts in-house in 1988. The charts and all music charts then and now are a mess. And even though charts feel like an institution that has always been there, the charts actually change over time. Their definitions and rules can be hundreds of pages long, and even then, it doesn't cover everything. It is a futile attempt, really, to try and categorise and measure art. Nothing illustrates this better for me than the EP. The EP has been around as a format for decades. In the 50s, it was a time of 7-inch singles. But by the mid-60s, with Sgt. Pepper and Bob Dylan and all that, the 12-inch album became the main format. But in between those two, in the late 50s, there was a rush of EPs. Elvis released a whole lot of EPs. The Beatles, the Beach Boys, and others did too. But what even is an EP? Well, it stands for extended play. And there were usually four or so tracks squeezed onto a 7-inch vinyl and sold for less than the cost of an album. They weren't a single, which had a clear A-side, and they weren't an album. Sometimes EPs were a few tracks from one album, like the Beatles put out an EP called Selections from a Hard Day's Night. Billboard in the US, who had been compiling and publishing various charts since the 1910s, started a top pop EP chart in 1957. The UK followed suit in 1960. There was a bit of an industry hype that the EP would become an important ongoing format alongside singles and albums. It would be a third format with a third chart. Everyone get excited. But of course, albums won the day and the popularity of the EP declined. Both the US and the UK EP charts folded by 1967. But people still made them, whether there was a chart or not. And if it was being sold, it should be tracked. If there's no EP chart, then where do EPs go? There's only two possible answers, and that's singles or albums. And because EPs were commonly that 7-inch in size, it made sense that they weren't albums. But they made an imperfect fit on the singles chart because there wasn't just an A-side with a B-side. But this is what happens when you try to categorise and measure art. In the 90s, in Australia in particular, EPs became very popular, at least in the indie scene. In fact, many of the most important releases of the decade were EPs. One of the most important was Ratcat's Tingles EP from 1990. That EP featured the smash hit song, That Ain't Bad. It was all over the radio and there was a film clip. But it wasn't released as a standalone single. The only place you could get that song was on this Tingles EP. So technically, it was the Tingles EP that got to number one in the ARIA singles chart. No song named That Ain't Bad by Ratcat ever topped the ARIA chart. It was this EP with a completely separate name. Throughout the 90s, you got a lot of EPs in the chart, mainly because the EP featured some sort of radio hit. Ordinary Angels by Frente was only on an EP called Clunk. Regurgitator's Blubber Boy was on an EP called New. Clouds, Magic Dirt, UMI, Jebediah, Something for Kate, and 50 others all released EPs with so-called radio singles. Often that radio was just Triple J and the community stations. They loved to support new Australian music. And in Australia, in the 90s, the EP thrived because you could be in a band and record something locally and not spend the big cost of making and promoting a full album. And yet you would still get on Triple J or community radio, and you could just start touring. It was a little bit more than just a single, and it gave people a better sense of you. You could also make a dollar or two more than a single as well. Sometimes you get two radio songs out of one EP. EPs weren't as big in the UK or the US. Almost none of the big 90s bands in those countries have cool EPs you have to get from before their first album. It made more sense to just go and make the album in those countries for various reasons. Nirvana made an EP once, and it was an Australian exclusive. But in the 90s, the change to the CD format took away one of the key definitions of what an EP even was, which was that traditional 7-inch single size. That Ratcat EP Tingles was released as a 12-inch and on CD. And of course, a CD is just a CD and could be damn well anything. So charts around the world and Australia changed their singles chart eligibility to be anything under a certain number of tracks. They tried to recategorize art. But some EPs, like Frente's World, had 8 tracks. And there's some albums I love from the 70s with 8 tracks or less. So number of tracks didn't work with the definition of what was a single. Then they tried to define a single by the length of the recording. Less than 30 minutes? Or should it be less than 25? Definitely less than the 40-ish minutes of an album, but quite a bit more than a single. But some EPs blew past that playing time quite easily. Dance singles in particular had collected all those 10-minute remixes and went way past that running time. So was that an album now? And that first Whitlams album, Introducing the Whitlams, was less than 30 minutes. Was that an EP? Then some bastard created the mini album. What was the difference between a mini album and an EP? Well, who the hell knows? Clouds released the Octopus so-called mini album, and Hard-Ons also released the Dateless Dudes Club mini album, both in 1992. Why were these different from EPs? And why does it matter? Well, because charts matter. People fight tooth and nail to get that extra spot. And if someone had a 9-track, 31-minute disc on the singles chart, and you were one spot below them, why wouldn't you pick up the phone to Billboard or ARIA and complain? If you want to see exactly how odd it all was, Ratcat's Tingles topped the ARIA singles chart. But the separate Australian Music Report, who ran the alternative chart at the time, included Tingles in albums and noted as a mini album. So Tingles was actually the highest selling album of 1990 according to one chart. Even today on Discogs, Tingles is listed in singles and EPs, but Cloud's Octopus mini album is listed in albums. Another funny one is Magic Dirt. Their EP Life Was Better charted in the singles chart at number 75 in 1995. And in 2020, when it was reissued, it charted at number 26 in the albums chart. The definition of what an EP was changed between then and now. Okay, I'm sure a lot of people don't care about this stuff. And don't worry, as much as I advocate for the odd thing on this podcast, there won't be a rant about justice for EPs. This is all just to say that charts and chart rules actually change, as does award rules. And they were changing as much in the 90s as any other decade. But the charts were big in the 90s. I feel like music fans just knew what was in the charts and followed it more often than they do now. If you lived through the 90s, then you will no doubt remember the physical ARIA Coca-Cola charts. They were one double-sided sheets that you could pick up from a record store or cafes, usually with other flyers and street press. And they had the charts on them. I was one of thousands of teenagers that picked them up every week. There was also the Take 40 Australian radio show that counted down the chart every week. It was reflected in music video chart shows. Information about what was in the charts was just kind of everywhere. In the little suburban CD store where I worked in the late 90s, we had a chart wall like so many other stores. And anything past 30 was actually usually bullshit. It was just albums that we had a lot of stock for that we wanted to move on. But sometimes we'd get called out for it by a regular. That's not in the charts. The chains actually did the same thing, but on a bigger scale. And Sanity and Blockbuster each tried to have their own chart. But ARIA by the mid-90s was really the biggest chart. And by the late 90s, all those chain charts sort of fell away. So let's look at how alternative music fared in the ARIA charts in the 90s. In 1989, the Hummingbirds were the first alternative band to break into the charts at all. They charted at number 31 with their debut album Love Buzz and number 19 with their first major label single, Blush. But it really was Rat Cat who were the real pioneers. As mentioned, their single, but not actually a single, but an EP called Tingles, got to number one for 2 weeks in 1991. It was the second highest selling single of 1991, behind Bryan Adams' Everything I Do It For You. There would be no other Australian alternative single to get so close to being the highest selling single of the year in the 90s. So in one way, the scene peaked in 1991. Rat Cat's album Blind Love also got to number one and was there for 3 weeks. It was the 35th highest selling album of 1991. 1992's biggest alternative success was Frente. Their EP, called Clunk, made it to number 20 in the highest selling singles of the year. That EP featured the song Ordinary Angels, and it was the only real chart success for the year for the whole scene. And 1993 was almost as bare. One Frente single, Accidentally Kelly Street, makes the highest selling singles list at number 87, and at least it was actually a single this time. And there is one album, The Cruel Seas, The Honeymoon Is Over, made it to number 40 in the highest selling albums list. In 1994 saw the second time an Australian alternative song would reach number one in the Australian singles chart. And guess what? It was an EP. At least the name was the same, but this time it was Silverchair's Tomorrow EP. It stayed at number one for 6 weeks. It was the ninth highest selling single of 1994. Frente are on the list again for the third time in a row with their Lonely EP, which was the 63rd highest selling single of the year. It featured the song Lonely, but it also featured their cover of Bizarre Love Triangle, which is what pushed it up the chart. 1995 saw Silverchair's Tomorrow make the list again as the 19th highest selling single of the year. It just kept selling well into 1995. Silverchair's Pure Massacre single also made it to number 31, and their debut album Frog Stomp hit number 1 in the albums chart for 3 weeks and was the 7th highest selling album of that year. But Frog Stomp wasn't the first Australian alternative album to hit number 1 that year. That would be UMI's Hi-Fi Way, which hit number one for 1 week a month before Silverchair. The Cruel Seas' Three-Legged Dog also made it to number one and sat there for 2 weeks. So we're in 1995 and we have three Australian alternative number one albums. The invasion was starting. There was, incredibly, nothing Australian alternative in the top 100 highest-selling singles of 1996. But over in albums, Frogstomp made the list of highest-selling albums again in 1996 at number 36. Powderfinger begins a career of chart dominance with their album Double Allergic being the 44th highest-selling album. And in terms of number one, there was only one in albums and none in singles. UMI's Ali Daly made it 2 number one albums in a row for the band. '97 saw the third and final Australian alternative number one single of the 90s. That's it. Only three songs ever topped the charts. And the third and last one was Freak by Silverchair. It topped the chart for 2 weeks. It had three songs in the highest selling singles of the year. Freak was at number 20 with Abuse Me and Cemetery also on the list. Just sneaking in as the 98th highest selling single of the year was Spider Bait with Calypso. Over in albums, Silverchair's Freak Show was the only album to reach number one and did so for just 1 week. It was also the 14th highest selling album of the year. But there were lots of albums on that highest selling albums of the year list. Spider Bait's Ivy and the Big Apples makes 37, Powderfinger's Double Allergic makes 53, Regurgitator's Unit at 93, Grinspoon's Guide to Better Living at 94, Leonardo's Bride's Angel Blood at 96, and The Whitlam's Eternal Nightcap at 97. That's seven different artists on the list. And then the next year, the biggest Australian alternative single of 1998 was Second Solution / Prisoner of Society EP, and not a single, by The Living End. It was number 6 on the highest selling singles list. Regurgitator's Polyester Girl makes number 67, and The Mavis's Cry makes number 90. 1998 saw three Australian alternative albums hit number 1. UMI's number 4 record for 1 week, Powderfinger's Internationalist for 1 week, and The Living End's self-titled debut for 2 weeks. UMI's three consecutive number one albums was a record, but it would soon be matched. Eight albums by eight different Australian alternative artists make the top 100 highest selling list of 1998. At 20 is Regurgitated Unit appearing again, 23 is The Whitlam's with Eternal Nightcap, 29 is The Living End with their self-titled debut, 37 is Super Jesus with Sumo, 54 is Slightly Odd Way by Jebediah, 64 is Grinspoon's Guide to Better Living, which carries across from the previous year, 66 is Powderfinger's Internationalist, and 96 is UMI's number 4 record. And then in 1999, the last year of the decade, the highest selling Australian alternative single was Silverchair's Anthem for the Year 2000 at number 29. That's four times where Silverchair had the highest selling Australian alternative single of the decade. They also appear again with Anna's song at number 85. Two other artists make the list, Killing Heidi's Weir at number 36 and The Living End's All Torn Down at number 93. There's only one number one album in 1999 that was Australian and alternative, and it was Silverchair with Neon Ballroom. They match UMI's record-breaking three number ones in a row. In albums, there was once again eight albums by eight artists. 13 is The Living End, 16 is Silverchair's Neon Ballroom, 17 is Powderfinger's Internationalist, and then there's a decent jump until number 62, which is Ben Lee's Breathing Tornadoes. 65 is Grinspoon's Easy. 69 is The Whitlam's Love This City. 70 is Jebediah's Of Someday Shambles. And number 83 is Regurgitator's Dot 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 Art. Both 1998 and 1999's eight albums is a record for the decade. That's also the peak. The alternative scene starts to go down after this. And let's not forget how small this all is. Eight albums out of the 100 highest selling albums of the year was the peak. That's it. 8 out of 100. The explosion of bands that marked the 90s is kind of over by the end of the 90s. The last season of Just Ace will kind of be all about dealing with the fallout and looking for survivors. But maybe sales isn't everything. Who cares? Because it's about art. It's about making great music. Well, we have another way to categorize and measure that, which was equally imperfect. And it's called the ARIA Awards. The ARIA Awards began in 1987. Previous to that, the closest we got to an Australian Music Award was the Countdown Music and Video Awards, which was voted by the viewers of the TV show Countdown. They had some peer-voted and industry awards, but the most popular awards were voted for by the public. At the 1985 Countdown Music and Video Awards, there was an incident between INXS fans and the fans of the Australian band The Uncanny X-Men. The end result was that ARIA decided not to support a popularity contest anymore. A more prestigious peer-voted award was what was needed. And when it came to this rising alternative scene, it took a few years for the peers to catch on. The kind of people who get to vote in the ARIAs come from all parts of the music industry. There's fellow musicians, but there's also people who might run a small CD store in regional Australia. The problem for alternative artists is that you can't get the vote if no one's heard of you. I guess that's true of all voting, so it's still partly a popularity contest. The ARIA Awards were filmed but not televised until 1992. So it's great that they gave the artists some recognition in those early years and that they captured the recognition for historical record, but they didn't give the artists a big boost by being on TV until 1992. And in those non-televised pre-1992 ceremonies, there were a few artists that got acknowledgements early on. In 1989, TISM won the award for Best Independent Release for their single I'm Interested in Apathy. It was a small blip for a band that was so different from everyone else when they launched. 1990 saw the Hummingbirds nominated for 3 awards that were all for new artists. The ARIA Breakthrough Artist Award is a funny one, as people often argue that it makes no sense. The Waifs were nominated for Breakthrough Artist in 2002 for a song that was on their 4th album. But Breakthrough kind of means that they charted, or charted well, for the first time. To complicate matters, in the 90s there was a separate Breakthrough Artist Award for albums and for singles. And nowadays, there's just one Breakthrough Artist Award. And then there was the Best New Artist Award, which was completely different and is less about a release. It's all a bit confusing, but just know that in 1990, the Hummingbirds were just nominated for all 3. It wasn't until 1992 that more bands were highlighted, but it wasn't many. The ceremony was held in March of 1992, so it covers the calendar year of 1991, and the only winner in the alternative world was Underground Lovers, winner of Best New Talent for their self-titled debut. Rat Cat's Blind Love was only nominated for Highest Selling Album, a category that no one votes for, it's just based on sales. Rat Cat had a number one album and 2 number one singles, but could barely get the respect. Died Pretty's Doughboy Hollow was nominated for Best Album, and that's a beautiful album and a deserved nomination. But this local alternative scene was still such a small blip. The ARIA Awards of 1993, which covered 1992, saw the first time more than one alternative artist won an award. And one of them won more than one, and that was Frente, who took out Breakthrough Artist Album and Breakthrough Artist Single for Marvin the Album and their single Ordinary Angels, which was actually an EP called Clunk. They were also nominated for Best Cover Art for Marvin the Album and Best Video for Ordinary Angels. The other winners were Things of Stone and Wood, who took out Best New Talent, and Weddings Parties Anything, who took out Best Song with Father's Day. Best Song is different to Best Single. Best Single is more about the recording. Best Song was about the songwriter. And if you think that's confusing, well, so did everyone else. The Best Song Award would be retired in 1998. But none of the bands from 1993, be it Frente, Things of Stone and Wood, or Weddings Parties Anything, sounded like Nirvana or alternative rock. All 3 were loved by commercial radio as well. There was a lot of change that was still to come. And 1994's ARIA Awards is where the change starts. From here on in, most years were dominated by one band. 1994 was the year of The Cruel Sea. They won 5 awards from 10 nominations. This includes the Big 3. Best Group, Album of the Year for The Honeymoon is Over, and Single of the Year for The Honeymoon is Over. The Cruel Sea also took out Song of the Year. The other win was for Tony Cohen, their producer. The Cruel Sea makes sense as the first band to win over the establishment. They were familiar to the established music industry. They had a traditional frontman and were a bit older than the other new bands. Cohen had worked with bands like Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Commercial radio played them too. but they were far from the manicured mega bands of old.
Take it away.
Please make a speech.
Oh, well, actually, I had a few people I wanted to thank here on the back of my dole check, which I didn't hand in today.
The band physically lost one of their awards that night. The story's had a few retellings. Initially, it was thought to be lost in Sydney Harbour. Eventually, it turned up on Facebook in 2022 by someone who found it in a bin. 1994 also saw the launch of the ARIA Award for Best Alternative Release. In 1994, I imagine ARIA thought that alternative was here to stay, like jazz and classical and dance, and there would never be a need to change this award's definition ever again. The first winner of the Alternative Release Award was UMI with their Sound As Ever album, and it was a strong field that featured various C bands, including Clouds, Crow, The Cruel Sea, and Coral Snakes, the last one featuring Dave Graney. It's interesting that The Cruel Sea didn't perform and have actually never performed at the ARIA Awards. Things of Stone and Wood performed Share This Wine, and UMI performed their classic Berlin Chair. 1995 saw Silverchair take out 5 awards from 9 nominations, but they missed out on some of the big ones. Best Group went to The Cruel Sea again. Album of the Year went to Tina Arena's Don't Ask. But other than that, it was very much their year. And there's no doubt now about Silverchair being alternative. They were the new generation and far younger than Tex Perkins. That the established industry were willing to celebrate them was a big deal. This stuff had arrived, even if it didn't win the big awards. What they did win was Single of the Year, Highest Selling Single, and Breakthrough Artist Single for their Tomorrow EP. They also won Breakthrough Artist Album for Frog Stomp and Best New Talent. In keeping with their strategy of humbleness and paying their dues, Silverchair didn't actually accept any of their awards on stage. They sent up Josh Shirley, the 7-year-old son of Silverchair's producer Kevin Shirley, to accept the awards. After a while, the poor kid got too embarrassed to go up again, and his dad went up instead.
Silverchair would like to thank Nomad, Triple J, Murma and Sony, Trading Post, their manager, their families, my dad, and anyone who likes their music. Thank you.
The Cruel Sea, meanwhile, added to their best group with wins for Tony Cohen for producer and engineer for his work on their album, Three-Legged Dog. Over at the more targeted awards for the scene, the Best Alternative Release Award went to UMI for Hi-Fi Way, their second win in a row. They beat out an exciting field of new artists like Custard, Magic Dirt, Regurgitator, and Silverchair. Hi-Fi Way was also nominated for Album of the Year. The Best Independent Release was won by TISM for their breakthrough album Machiavelli in the Four Seasons. They beat out Def FX and Magic Dirt. TISM appeared in the pre-recorded opening sketch for the awards, but they didn't go on stage to accept their award. They sent up SBS presenter Les Murray, who made a speech in his native Hungarian. It translates to, "When the revolution comes, the music industry will be the first to go. Thank you very much."
This is serious, okay. In the immortal words of the great Hungarian centre forward, Nándor Hidegkuti. Please, do you mind? Amikor eljön a forradalom, a zeneipar lesz az első, amely menni fog. Köszönöm szépen, thank you very much.
She didn't win, but Mac Sharam was nominated for Best Female Artist. She was nominated for several awards, including Best Single, Song of the Year, Best Video, and Breakthrough Artist for Single, for Coma, which was an EP. She was also nominated for Best New Talent and Breakthrough Artist Album for A Million Year Girl. She did win one award, though, Best Cover Art for her album, won by Dominic O'Brien. The night ended with a performance by Silverchair, but not just any performance. The band invited Tim Rogers of UMI to perform a cover, and they chose Radio Birdman's New Race, a classic Australian 70s punk song, but not a song that was popular on the radio. Even the song's title and visceral attitude seemed to announce a change was gonna come. It started a little tradition of Australian bands covering Australian songs to close out the awards.
I'm gonna mute it.
1996 was the first year I watched the whole ARIA Awards from start to finish, because UMI got 9 nominations and would win 6, which was a record at the time. UMI were dressed in old brown suits that was part of their look for their new album, Ali Daily. They looked different from everyone else. They also looked kind of weirded out by it all.
We just finished the tour last night, and I just want to thank all the people who paid their working dollar to come and see us do live out our little adolescent fantasies, and maybe see you again sometime. Right.
Along with Best Group, they won Album of the Year and Best Independent Release for Ali Daily. The band would later joke that Ali Daily was the lowest-selling ARIA Album of the Year of all time. In Independent Release, UMI beat an incredible field of Custard, Tism and Underground Lovers. UMI also won as Producer of the Year, and Paul McKercher and Wayne Connolly took out Engineer of the Year. Andrew Lancaster also won for directing the UMI film clip Soldiers, which I love and I would say is well-deserved. Later on, I would see these ARIA awards at the UMI office. Tim said that some of them were in his bathroom, but he was probably just being funny in an interview. They also had heaps of nomination awards, which were like ARIA awards, but about one-third the size. They look like baby ARIA awards. UMI lost out in Best Alternative Album, though. They lost to Regurgitator for their album Tuplang, which also won Breakthrough Artist Album. For that alternative award, Regurgitator beat out Pollyanna and Spiderbait as well. They were also nominated for Best Group and Album of the Year. Dave Graney won for Best Male Artist. He got up in his pink suit, sunglasses and wig and declared himself the King of Pop. He also mentioned that he's never been a solo artist, so it was weird for him to win. Previously, Tex Perkins was also nominated for Best Male Artist for his solo work, Tex, Don and Charlie. There's actually 2 other people in the name of that band, so it's confusing.
I'm not really a solo artist, so I must, of course, accept this on behalf of my wife and a musical collaborator for almost 20 years, Claire Moore, and the other members of the Coral Snakes, Rod Hayward, Gordy Blair and Robin Casaneda. And I'll thank...
Melbourne band Rail got 2 nominations, Breakthrough Artist Single for Immune Deficiency and Best New Talent for their album Bad Hair Life. Powderfinger played on the night performing Pick You Up, which was also nominated for Single of the Year. And UMI closed the show with a cover of the Easy Beats classic, I'll Make You Happy. I clearly remember the newspapers the day after the 1997 ARIA Awards. They told me that Australia's flirtation with alternative was over. Pop was back. Brisbane duo Savage Garden smashed UMI's 1996 record of 6 wins from 9, with a mammoth 10 wins from 13. That remains the most awards won by one artist at a single ceremony. From the alternative field, the biggest winner was the Super Jesus. They won Best New Talent and Breakthrough Artist Single for their EP and not single, 8-Step Rail. Those were 2 categories that Savage Garden simply weren't nominated for. The Super Jesus performed at the ceremony, playing their more recent single, Down Again. I remember watching it on TV and wondered why the camera couldn't just hold still. Both Spiderbait and Powderfinger had 7 nominations, and Silverchair had 6. All 3 of those bands were nominated for the Album of the Year, Single of the Year, and Best Group. Spiderbait won the Best Alternative Release, another category that Savage Garden simply weren't eligible for. They beat out The Foes and Powderfinger, but Silverchair, interestingly, weren't nominated. More weird than that, Snout's album, The New Pop Dialogue, was nominated for Best Pop Release, alongside Savage Garden and Human Nature. In the New and Breakthrough Artist Awards, nominees included new voices like Jebediah, The Earthmen, Rebecca's Empire, Finney's Scad, and Leonardo's Bride. Leonardo's Bride's Wonderful Even When I'm Sleeping was also nominated for Single of the Year, and they also performed that song at the ceremony. Savage Garden were technically on an independent label, distributed by a major. So they also won Best Independent Music, beating out Dead Star and Even. Silverchair's only win came for Best Cover Art, credited to John Watson and John O'Donnell, who were Silverchair's manager and label head, as well as artist Kevin Wilkins. They also performed their song Freak at the ceremony. Alternative world artists were nominated for both Best Cover Art and Best Video. Janet English from Spiderbait did their album cover for Ivy and the Big Apples and the video for Calypso. Tony Mahoney, who did all of Dave Graney's art design in these years, was nominated for his artwork for the album The Devil Drive and won for the Dave Graney film clip Feeling Kinda Sporty. The closing night cover came from Crowded House, who had just broken up but got back together to do a wonderful version of Paul Kelly's Leaps and Bounds. Looking over the bridge to the MCG, and way up on high, the clock on the silo says 11 degrees. The big winner on the night of the 1998 ARIA Awards was Natalie Imbruglia. If you count Silverchair and Savage Garden, ARIAs were being dominated by artists on their first album. She won 6 from 9 nominations. But she couldn't win Best Group. That went to the Whitlams, who also won Best Independent Release for Eternal Nightcap and Song of the Year for No Aphrodisiac. They had 8 nominations all up, including for Album and Single of the Year. Rob Taylor was nominated for Producer and Engineer. And in terms of Best Group, they beat out a field of Regurgitator, Super Jesus, UMI, and Savage Garden. In a brilliant move by ARIA, they managed to get ex-Prime Minister Gough Whitlam himself to present the Best Group Award. And Gough was hilarious. He was always a great speaker, and great speakers know comic timing. But then the Whitlams walked on stage, and instead of accepting their award, they kneeled before the former Prime Minister.
It's my family.
In the independent release category, the Whitlams beat out Karma County, The Living End, and Tism. Regurgitator also got 8 nominations. They took home the prestigious Album of the Year and Best Alternative Release for Unit. Their collaborator, Magoo, took the Producer and Engineer honours. Juan from the band and his partner Janet English took the award for Best Cover Art. Regurgitator also performed at the ceremony, playing Exclamation Mark, the song formerly known as. For alternative release, Regurgitator beat out Dirty 3, The Living End, Paradise Motel, and UMI. In 1998, ARIA introduced the Best Rock Album Award for the first time. As a genre, rock had been going for like 50 years, and alternative was going for like 3 when it got its own ARIA Award. Still, Super Jesus won the very first ARIA Award for rock with their album Sumo. And surprisingly, the rock category wasn't flooded with alternative acts. But they did beat out one alternative band, with Mola's Golden Duck album being nominated. There's more alternative artists nominated for Best Pop Release than there was for Best Rock Release, because pop included Snout Again, The Whitlams, The Mavises, and Kylie for her alternative-inspired Impossible Princess album. The highest-selling single ARIA went to The Living End for their Second Solution Prisoner of Society EP. They went ahead and performed Second Solution and not the bigger hit of Prisoner of Society. Also performing on the night was the Mavises, who played Cry, and Jebediah, who played Teflon. The latter was nominated for Breakthrough Artist Album with Slightly Odd Way, but lost to Natalie Imbruglia. Grinspoon and Cordrazine were also nominated. Diana Arnaid was nominated and lost to Natalie in the Best New Talent and Breakthrough Artist Single categories for I Go Off. The Whitlams closed the show with a cover of Skyhook's Women in Uniform. But that was the last of the Australian covers. It was also the last Song of the Year and Best New Talent Awards, which were both retired after this.
To the station for a breath test, then back to a bedroom for some hot syrups. Women in uniform, sometimes they look so cold. Women in uniform, but I knew they feel so cold.
We end where this podcast will likely end, with Powderfinger, who dominated the 1999 ARIA Awards. They had 4 wins from 5 nominations. They took out Album of the Year for Internationalist and Single of the Year for The Day You Come. They also won Best Rock Album. Kevin Wilkins, who previously won for Silverchair's Freak Show, wins for Best Cover Art for Internationalist. It's an album cover that I love a lot. Wilkins would work with Powderfinger again. It's actually Kevin naked on the cover of Powderfinger's next album, Odyssey No. 5. But Best Group went to The Living End. They beat out a ridiculous field of Powderfinger, Regurgitator, Silverchair and UMI. They also took Breakthrough Artist Album for their self-titled debut. They were nominated for Album of the Year as well. Another winner was UMI's Tim Rogers, who won Best Male Artist for his solo album, What Rhymes with Cars and Girls. He was presented with the award by Harry Connick Jr., who made a snide remark about Tim needing a comb.
Can I borrow your comb when you do it?
Later on, Powderfinger got on to accept an award, and in a great moment, drummer John took the time to lay one back on Harry Connick Jr. and mocked his hammy acting in Independence Day from on stage.
Oh yeah, and Harry Connick Jr., you better watch out, mate. Paying out on Tim Rogers. I mean, we just love that ID4 movie, you know, that blow-up scene. You're in the jet. How'd they teach you that?
Brisbane band Not From There took out the award for Best Alternative Release with their debut, Sand on 7. They also picked up nominations for Breakthrough Artist Single and Album. In Alternative, Not From There beat out Girling, Tim Rogers, Something for Kate, Spiderbait and Tendrils, a new band featuring Joel Silbersher from the band God. It says a lot that the big names like Powderfinger, Silverchair and The Living End weren't considered alternative, or the voting pool decided to go more obscure with the genre awards. Either way, the Alternative Award would be retired in 2001. The ARIA Award for Alternative Release lasted just 8 years. But so many artists from our story are peppered throughout the 1999 nominations. Silverchair got the most nominations with 9, although their only award win was for Nick Launay's work as engineer. Spiderbait performed Shazam and Plastic from their Grand Slam album. They were nominated for 5 awards, including Album of the Year. Regurgitator were nominated for 4 awards, for their exclamation mark song formerly known as single, which they performed at the ARIAs the year before. So they performed their song I Want to Be a Nudist from their new album ... Art instead. When they performed, they were surrounded by bodybuilders on stage. Friends or Rom were nominated for Best Rock Album with A Man's Not a Camel and Breakthrough Artist Single for You Are Not My Friend. They had one of the best performances in ARIA history. Singer Jay was wheeled on from a hospital bed. He was joined by a band all dressed in hospital gowns as they rocked out. But then, Jay started spilling forth with blood, lots of blood, covering Jay in a huge cartoonish gory mess. It looked amazing on TV. Other notable nominees were Ben Lee, who picked up nods for Album and Single of the Year, as well as Best Male Artist. Dead Star was nominated for Best Pop Release, Diana Arnaid was nominated for Best Independent Release, and Andrew Lancaster, who directed Custard's excellent Girls Like That Don't Go For Guys Like Us video, won for Best Video. Killing Heidi closed out the night. They weren't nominated for anything, but their single Weird was a massive hit, so they just put them on TV anyway. And this is where we get to, in 1999, with all these nominees, and Killing Heidi appearing on TV just cause. It was a far cry from the early years where bands like Ratcat, who topped the charts, was barely acknowledged or nominated. By the end of the 90s, alternative artists were being asked to play even if they weren't nominated at all. I can see a pattern forming at the end of the decade. The thing with any scene was that there's hundreds of bands who last a moment. Some bands last a summer, and then some last a few years. But as we head into the final season of Just Ace, we'll look at the ones that survived and managed to outlive the 90s. Arias are only one metric of that, but the most successful bands of the late 90s managed to survive. Powderfinger, Silverchair, The Living End, and more. But of course, just because something sold more than something else doesn't mean it was better. If anything, I hope I've painted the picture across previous episodes about how it's a mix of the right moment, fickle tastes, market forces, the trucks you have, technological change, and a few people's uninformed opinions that could make or break you. And also, an album that won an award doesn't automatically mean it's better than one that doesn't, or that one album cover is better than another album cover. But these lists and institutions have their place. When they work, they reach a lot of people. Yes, this stuff exists in indie record stores and rock mags and late-night music video shows, but the ARIA Awards were prime-time television, reported on the news. For some bands in the 90s, this may have been the only time they were seen on commercial TV. Just getting mentioned as a nominee for Best New Artist is great exposure. It gets way past the indie scene. It's not about measuring art, it's about giving it a spotlight. And unfortunately, there are just limited spotlights. Another reason these lists are important is because I'm talking about them now. These lists, the charts and awards, last. They are remembered and their achievement is protected. I'm not talking about the Sanity in-store charts they produced in the 90s. The ARIA charts are the only ones that matter. And it's not about protecting or remembering Silverchair or UMI in particular. These bands were all tied to the intricate, complicated and maddening scene. And all bands are. Do you know how hard it is to find out anything about Finiscad? We need these big bands to lead people in. UMI were my gateway drug to the whole scene. They won all those arias just as I was falling in love with them. It played a part. I care that they won, and I care that they charted, even if the band doesn't. But in the end, in this whole series about the fight between alternative and mainstream, this is how much, or how little, the alternative scene won. Alternative managed to crash the bigger stages and top the charts, and they won awards. Well, they did for a little bit. A few albums here and there, a couple of number ones, 8 albums in the top 100, and then it went away. There's got to be more ways to whittle down the hundreds of albums, singles and EPs released in a decade and have a way into a scene. And looking at, say, just the albums that were nominated for the ARIA Album of the Year is one way to go. And there are 18 albums that fit the category of alternative, in my mind, that was nominated for the ARIA Award for Best Album. Groups age, but albums, the great ones, they last. And here are 18 in order of nomination. Some of them won, but who cares about that? They are Doughboy Hollow by Die Pretty, The Honeymoon Is Over by The Cruel Sea, Hi-Fi Way by UMI, Frog Stomp by Silverchair, Three-Legged Dog by The Cruel Sea, Owly Daily by UMI, Two Plank by Regurgitator, Ivy and the Big Apples by Spiderbait, Freak Show by Silverchair, Double Allergic by Powderfinger, Unit by Regurgitator, Number 4 Record by UMI, Eternal Nightcap by The Whitlams, Internationalist by Powderfinger, Grand Slam by Spiderbait, Neon Ballroom by Silverchair, The Living End Self-Titled by The Living End, and Breathing Tornadoes by Ben Lee. There's lots of lists peppered throughout this podcast, and this is just one of them, these 18 albums. But this list is the one that lives in that mansion of the hill. They are the pillars of the scene, the ones that reached millions of homes. Rightly or wrongly, these are the albums that will be remembered, and I think on the whole, they are all very deserving of that accolade. Okay, it's the end bit, and it's the bit where I talk about how to support the podcast. And once again, and for the last time this season, I'm going to talk about that damn book because it's new and I'm very proud of it. The book is based on the first two seasons of the podcast, but it isn't the podcast scripts. They have been rewritten as a book, but they tell the same story. So the podcasts on UMI and Ratcat and Silverchair are all adapted as a book for you to enjoy. You don't ever need to know there was a podcast, although that's strange to say if you're listening to this. You can get the book on Amazon, sure, or I started to get a few into record stores, and some of them will even sell them to you online. Links to places where you can get the book will be on the website, and there's a link in the description. I've gotten some really good reactions to the book, and people who have never listened to the podcast have told me they enjoyed it, which is probably the best bit. Not everyone is a podcast person, and finding new people who want these stories is why it exists. There is, of course, also the Patreon, and the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee, and a merch store for shirts and bags and things on Redbubble. There's also excellent no-cost ways of supporting the podcast, like leaving me 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and on Amazon if you bought the book there. You can also follow me on social media, share the posts, and very importantly, tell a friend. Spread the word. All the links are in the description, as well as links to socials and the website and YouTube, and how to get in contact with me. Next week, we look at a band that made one of the most expensive albums of the 90s.
Start again.